Bible Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Welcome to our hosts, Susan Franson and Gina McAndrew.
Thank you, Mike. Gina and I are happy to welcome you listeners to an entire program about being outdoors in Iowa, starting with railroad history with railroad historian Bob Byrne. We'll have Lisa Hine from Natural Heritage Foundation telling us about the transformation of abandoned railroad lines through Iowa's High Trestle Trail. And we look down at the Des Moines River. As we do that from the trail bridge, we have reason to think about the many rivers and creeks in Iowa and the organization that cares for them, Prairie Rivers of Iowa. Doug Cooper and Mike Kellner are coming by to tell us how that organization is celebrating its 21st birthday in August. And Steve Lekwa, retired Story County Conservation Officer, will answer the question, who were the Iowa?
Boy, that's quite an impressive group of guests. I'm sure eager to hear Bob Byrne with the railroad history. He's not only a railroad historian, but the vice president of the Ames Historical Society. So it's a real honor that he's joining us today.
Hi, Bob. Now that you've been introduced, we are happy to be able to welcome you. We really need someone who knows the complicated history. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Susan and Gina. It's really nice to be here. I listen to KHOI quite a bit, so it's kind of an honor to be on the radio. And I love talking about railroads, so wherever you want to go, I'll wander through a lot of topics. So you got to keep me on task a little bit.
I'd like to start at the beginning. I've heard that Iowa has more railroad tracks than any other state, or had more than any other state. And as people in central Iowa towns know, there are still a lot of trains running frequently in all seasons. Bob, could you tell us why so many trains run through Iowa now and had their tracks built decades ago?
Yeah, Iowa had just over 10,000 miles of rail line in 1915. That was the peak year. And then there was another roughly 1,500 miles in the terminals and the yards and the switching areas. So it was an extensive network. The first line in Iowa was in Davenport in, I think it was 1854, and the bridge was built in 1855. So we actually had a railroad before we had the crossing on the Mississippi River. So that was the beginning of it. The Land Grant Act, I believe, was 1850. But essentially, the land grant concept was that the federal government gave the railroads either a 200 or 400 foot right of way, and then they gave them, it looked like a checkerboard if you look at it, they gave them about six sections. Every other section as you went along on either side of the line for development. And what they wanted, the federal government wanted was the settlement of the West. I mean, the entire westward expansion, manifest destiny, all those concepts at the time. So the rail lines took off. We had several primarily east-west through Iowa because we were building to the west coast. The north-south lines didn't really happen until later. And the concept was that the prevailing thought was that a farmer could take his wagon about 7 miles to a rail terminal. So you wanted roughly a 14-mile spacing. Well, it didn't quite happen that way, but it is a fairly about a 20-mile spacing on the east-west lines. And the land was good. It was very productive. There was a lot of immigrant labor that built it, a lot of immigrants that settled in Iowa. And the economic development in, you know, the big cities, Waterloo, Dubuque, Des Moines, you know, generated a lot of traffic. We had a lot of coal mines in Iowa. It was a pretty low-grade coal. Even some peat mines, but the trains needed coal for the steam engines, and then coal was a primary heating source for houses. So there was a big market for that, and a lot of the coal went east to big cities there. Illinois and Indiana had gigantic coal fields in central Illinois, central Indiana, and they provided a lot of coal also. So we had big coal mining cities that would spring up, and they'd pull all the coal out of the ground and ship it, and then in 10 or 15 years, whenever everything was mined, then the towns would disappear. But the permanent towns stayed, the tracks stayed, and then as the mode of transportation changed at the beginning of the 20th century, you had this fixed infrastructure that you couldn't just pick up and move. So what happened is there was a gradual decline through the early 20th century as highways were built, and then by the mid-20th century, the railroads were pretty much moving just high-volume, low-value commodities. And it's interesting now that that's changed back with the shipments. You see the container trains going through Ames. A lot of that is imports from China and Southeast Asia. So there's high-value cargo, again, on the railroads. So it's an interesting history on how the railroads started and what they carried, and they changed over time. So the early abandonments were really, I think the first abandonments were in like the late 1890s as the coal mines were being dried up. And some of that land went back to the farmers, and some of it was sold off. When the railroads built, they had the land grant for the primary east-west lines, but then a lot of the other lines, they would buy land from a farmer or they would get an easement. If it was an easement when the line was abandoned, then it reverted back to the farmer. If they had purchased the right-of-way, then they could sell that. And a lot of that intact right-of-way became the basis of the bicycle trails throughout the state.
So did they have, when you said they were separated by 7 miles, was that 7 miles between the lines going north and south? But I mean, the lines were going east to west?
Or well, it was 14 miles. The theory was that a farmer could go 7 miles with his wagon. So 14 miles was the design. It didn't quite work out that way. There was one line, Highway 30 here, we had the Northwestern, and you go up to Highway 20, that was the Illinois Central. That's probably, 25 miles between those. So it didn't quite work out, but that was the theory on it. And then you had these branch lines that would pick up. We did have a lot of branch lines throughout the state. That's how we got the high mileage on that. And then they would pick up 7 mile spread through, in the north-south or secondary lines. Like Highway 175, goes through Radcliffe and that. That had a line that ran, I think it was from Tama over to Fort Dodge as an example. And that was a secondary line that disappeared quite a while ago.
So then when the farmers sold their materials, would they stop all along the line, or were there... How did they figure out where the railroad stops were?
Well, the railroads didn't want them like a bus line where you stop every block. I mean, they wanted a spacing of 5 to 10 miles between towns. So Ames to Nevada is a good example. Ames to the stop to the west was Ontario, which is the where the grain elevator still is. That's the next stop. That's one reason there wasn't a stop at Iowa State, is because the railroad stopped in Ames and then it stopped in Ontario. And then Jordan was the next one, and then boom. So the towns were defined. There was usually an elevator. I think the history of Gilbert is interesting because they had an elevator, and it was pretty much a self-contained town. Gilbert had a dentist and a doctor and everything. And the services were brought to the town, and people could get to the towns. Now, of course, with automobiles, the services are more consolidated because people can drive longer distances. And that was another reason that a lot of the towns, small towns that, dried up is because the it was easier to travel longer distances once the highway network was in place.
And there got to be some kind of competition and concentration with the railroad, didn't there?
Yeah, there was a lot of competition, and it led to regulation. So a lot of times they would compete. There were a lot of small towns that had two railroad lines in them. Story City is a good example. They had the north-south line that still exists from Ames to Eagle Grove. And then there was an east-west line that went from Story City to Marshalltown. And that was a branch line of the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad. And there was one train a day that went back and forth. At one time, there were two passenger round trips a day. Then by 1920s or so, it was down to one round trip a day. And then that was abandoned in the 1970s. And then that became the Prairie, one of the first bike paths in the state. It was a gravel path. I haven't been up there recently. I don't know if it's paved yet or not, or if it's still gravel. But yeah, the point is there was a lot of competition, and that's why there were a lot of these two lines to a lot of small cities. And then as they got abandoned, some of them remained intact, like the Prairie Trail, and others weren't.
How did that work out? Like each company would have to install their own lines, or did they buy them and sell them to the highest bidder? How did all that work? Like, who got which line?
Well, this was a pretty much a high-tech, this was the high-tech of the 1880s, This is where the investors made their investments to make the big money, just like you buy all that Google and all that other stock that you buy, This investments in railroads were a solid investment. It was a physical asset. So they basically laid out the line and then surveyed it. And the only time there was a holding company would be like when they were going to build a bridge over the Mississippi River. The railroad would create a separate company so that if something happened to the bridge, it wouldn't affect the parent railroad. The line through Ames, the Union Pacific through Ames, was originally built as the Cedar Rapids and Missouri River, and the Chicago and Northwestern ran from Cedar Rapids to Chicago. They built this holding company to build the line, and then if they made a profit or built it with no problem, then the parent company bought it. And there was a lot of trading, a lot of stock trading and that kind of stuff. But it was pretty much you got the right of way, and then you went forward with it. It was interesting, the first line to Des Moines was what's called a narrow gauge. The distance between the rails was only 3 feet. The standard distance on trains now is 4 feet, 8.5 inches. And that was built on the cheap. They built it as cheaply as possible. And the smaller distance had smaller cars, smaller locomotives, lighter bridges and that. And that was the line, the first north-south line that came to Ames. Was from Des Moines, and it was a narrow gauge. And then the line north from Ames, which is the line that goes through Ames by the high school up to Gilbert, that was originally a narrow gauge also. And then they were widened in the mid-1880s to a standard gauge. So they did a lot of things to save money. They tried to build things cheaply. It was all about making a profit. So you kept your costs as low as you could and charge as much as you can. Eventually, the Granger laws were passed in, I believe it was the 1880s or so, and that regulated rates. The Interstate Commerce Commission was created in 1883, and that regulated the rates. So if you were going to ship grain from Story City to Chicago, you had a choice of two railroads, but the price was the same on both of them. And that was part of the rate regulation that came in because when they had a monopoly, they would gouge the public. It's kind of like the way airlines, charge it for everything now and have variable rates. So the same thing existed then, but it was highly regulated because it had such an impact on the economy.
How did they work with the towns? Did the towns often come after the railroad would appear or kind of at the same time or...
Well, there was competition among towns, and some of them offered incentives for the railroads. And I find it interesting that railroads were going for tax incentives in the 1880s. Des Moines held out. The Des Moines to Ames line was built actually it didn't have Des Moines and it didn't have Ames in it. It was in between, and Des Moines held out and finally paid a subsidy, and Ames paid its first subsidy in 1875. They paid $10,000 to the Des Moines and Minneapolis Railroad to complete the line into Ames, $10,000 tax dollars, you know, local property tax, and then they also gave them some land at the same time. So the railroads came with their hands out, and then the towns, it was a make or break. It's just like Zenersville doesn't have much of history. I mean, it had a coal, you know, it's west of Gilbert, a couple miles west of Gilbert, never had a rail line. It had a coal mine, had some houses and some businesses, but, you know, it dried up, and Gilbert continued, you know, flourished, partially because of the rail line. So the towns that didn't subsidize the rail tended to disappear, and those that did tended to prosper in the, you know, early 20th century.
What's the freight mostly? It seems like mostly coal, and so what are some of the other items that are taken on the trains through Iowa?
Well, coal is down a lot. There's not much coal anymore. And that's part of the conversion of natural gas for the power. A lot of the coal is moving from Wyoming now, is moving west to California, and then it gets shipped to China. And they burn American coal in China. Through Ames, the double stack trains, you know, with the trailers on top of each other, a lot of that is commercial goods going generally east. West, a lot of times they're empty. We have a lot of ethanol trains, the tank cars that you see, and then there's just a lot of mixed freight, you know. There's not much grain. A lot of grain is trucked now to ethanol plants. It was a big market going to the Mississippi River and then transloaded onto barges, but that dried up with the ethanol plants. And then the trains with all the funny different shapes have, you know, anything from coiled steel to animal fats and all kinds of things. There's train cars go from the over in Marshalltown at the packing plant over there. You know, they collect the animal fat, and then it goes over to Boone, and they make cookies over at Archway. So the Boone and Scenic Valley switches a couple of cars a week of animal fat that goes into your cookies. So that's a short one, but you'll see that going through Ames.
Oh, wow.
And any commodity that's heavy and bulky, road salt that the cities buy, you know, that.
Excuse me. Excuse me. I think it's time for us to prepare for our next segment. That was a great lead into an announcement that Boone and Scenic Valley Railway is. Of course, that's our passenger train. And Puffer Billy Days will be August 6th to 8th, and it's a big celebration in Boone, and we'll probably have a little bit to say about that on a future program. And thanks so much, Bob. This is a great lead-in to our next story, which we'll have after our music break, which will be about rails to trails.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Yep. Always happy to talk about history.
I can hear that number 9. goes rolling by. Freight train gone so fast. Freight train gone at last. Please don't tell what train I'm on, so know where I'm going.
A lot of those abandoned railroad beds have been developed into bike trails, which is why Iowa went from having the most railroad lines to having the most bike trails of any state. The organization most responsible for the transition has been the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. From our archives, we have an interview with Ursula Rudenberg and Lisa Hine, who's the program planning director of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, and they discussed the High Trestle Trail Bridge across the Des Moines River.
This is Ursula Rudenberg for Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm here with Lisa Hine from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Natural Heritage Foundation does?
Sure. Thanks. The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation has been around since 1979, and we are a nonprofit land conservation organization. So we actually work throughout the entire state of Iowa in helping to protect lands that become wildlife areas, habitat, county parks, state parks. We help communities work on projects that help protect natural areas and groundwater and things like that. And because of our experience in land protection and land acquisition, early on we got involved in helping acquire discontinued railroad corridors. Some of the very first trail projects that we were involved in include Cedar Valley Nature Trail that runs from Cedar Falls in Waterloo to Cedar Rapids, and the Heritage Trail, which runs outside of Dubuque, the Raccoon River Valley Trail, the Wabash Trace Nature Trail, 63 miles in southwest Iowa. And the trails are a great way for people to get outside and enjoy nature, and then hopefully that will lead to a greater awareness of the overall need to protect our environment and protect the Iowa landscape.
One of the most spectacular is the High Trestle Bridge. For anybody who has seen it, especially at night, it's an unforgettable sight. Can you describe a little bit what is on the High Trestle Bridge?
The High Trestle Bridge is part of the High Trestle Trail, and the High Trestle Trail runs from Ankeny through Slater, Madrid, over to Woodward. So it's 25 miles. The bridge itself spans the Des Moines River Valley between Madrid and Woodward. So it sits 13 stories in the air, and it's a half mile long. It was part of the Union Pacific Railroad corridor that was discontinued in about 2003. When the railroad discontinued use, they took down the decking to use at their new bridge that was going in over the Des Moines River near Boone, part of their main line that runs through Ames. And so we were left with, I think it's 44 pillars across the river valley. So there were pillars that were left, but no connections. So part of the project was actually having to rebuild the bridge surface and the bridge deck.
So how did it become a bike trail and a hiking trail?
Yeah. When Union Pacific Railroad planned for the discontinuance of that line, we stepped in to negotiate the purchase of that line for public use, and they provided a significant bargain sale to us, so they contributed a lot of land value. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation formed a steering committee made up of representatives from Ankeny, Sheldahl, Slater, Madrid, and Woodward, and Story County, Boone County, Dallas County, and Polk County. So the steering committee worked together, and we helped guide them to find grant dollars to help build the trail. The first two sections built in about 2006 were a mile in Ankeny and a half mile or less in Woodward. And in 2006, Congress authorized a special appropriation for this project of a little over $5 million. That was the spark that really gave us the leverage to build a large section of it. And I think what really put the icing on the cake was the art. I got the idea of putting art on trail bridges from the folks down in Fairfield, Iowa. They're involving artists on their trail bridges. bridges, and they got the idea from Tucson, Arizona. So I suggested to the committee, what do you think of this idea? Let's see about putting some art on the bridge. And they're like, sure, that sounds great. David Dahlquist, the public artist that you see a lot of his work across Iowa, he was selected by the committee, and he did the concepts for what we call cribs, the square shapes that are lit up. There's a lot of coal mining history in this part of the river valley. So that square shape is based on what you would see entering a coal mine. And then he rotated it so that it would give some interest. There's pillars on each end, about 40-foot tall pillars on each end.
With coal on them.
Yeah, seams of coal that have been actually clay tile that Dahlquist created. And the cribs go across the entire bridge, but over the river valley, they're about 15 feet apart, and that's the part that's lit up. So, and that's, it rotates all across the bridge, but that part is very dense.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Lisa Hine, Program Planning Director of the Natural Heritage Foundation, talking with Ursula Rudenberg about the work of the foundation in converting a major railroad bridge across the Des Moines River into a spectacular walking and bicycling trail known as the High Trestle Trail. Continuing with our main theme of major features in Iowa, we turn to our rivers. Prairie Rivers RC&D is the organization that concerns itself with the health of our watersheds and the quality of the water in rivers and streams. Here to tell us about their work is their president, Doug Cooper, and their communications director, Mike Kellner. Welcome to both of you. But I think I'll start with Doug, who I know is eager to announce the festival that will mark the 21st birthday of Prairie Rivers. Then I'll turn to Gina to question Mike about the work of the organization. So, Doug, how is Prairie Rivers celebrating its 21st birthday?
Well, 21st birthday, we're going to be legal to have a beer, so we're going to go to Alluvio and have a beer that's been brewed just for us. So we're looking forward to that very much. And I think it's important that we talk about Prairie Rivers of Iowa right now, because a lot of times people hear that and they're not sure exactly what it is. So I've asked Mike to help me out here. I'm new to the board, so I'm not as familiar with everything that they're involved in. And Mike, why don't you explain what Prairie Rivers of Iowa is?
Okay, well, thanks, Doug and Susan, and thank you for having us on this morning, and thanks to the audience for tuning in. So, as Susan kind of alluded to in our introduction, is Prairie Rivers of Iowa, again, since we, you know, our 21st birthday, so we were formed in 2000 as a resource conservation and developmental council, which where the RC&D comes from, and in Susan's introduction. That was formed by the USDA Natural Resources and Conservation Service. And the mission at that time was to improve quality of life and the environment in rural communities, which is still pretty much our mission today. You know, things change. Funding changes, mission changes. Our environment has seen a great change during that time. So we still pretty much have that mission, although we have evolved into some more specific programs that we're doing. So we have a couple of programs that we really focus on, and one is our wildlife and watershed program, and that does a couple things. So, one, our watershed coordinator, David Stein, he's actually kind of involved into a watersheds and wildlife coordinator now, and a lot of his work is not only kind of helping others implement soil practices for better soil, but really along with that, a lot of those conservation practices are really designed not only to improve soil quality, but to help water quality, which which is really a big part of our focus right now. As I think a lot of the audience probably knows, most streams, rivers, lakes in Iowa are impaired right now. So, in fact, I think there was 8 beach closings over the weekend here that because of dangerous levels of E. coli and toxins from algae blooms. So a big part of our work is doing that. We really help communities, counties, cities, other allied professionals and organizations determine the quality of the water. We do a lot with measuring excess nutrients and pollutions that enter our water source. And then hopefully those kind of things are evolving into some plans to help get it cleaned up. So that's a big part of it. But then the other part on the wildlife side is we are doing a lot of work on restoring habitat, particularly for pollinators like the endangered rusty patch bumblebee.
What is that?
The rusty patch bumblebee. Okay, so I hope I'm the best person to answer this question. We really need David here, our expert, to answer that. But the rusty patch bumblebee is a bumblebee, of course. And it is, I believe, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, the only endangered pollinator insect species in the state of Iowa. There are many others that are threatened or species of special conservation concern as determined by the National Fish and Wildlife Service. But the rusty patch is endangered, and it is rapidly disappearing in Iowa. Very few places, it's a native bee to Iowa, and very few places have any left. There has been a sighting in Ames, but just, I think recently in the last couple of years, maybe one sighting. So, a lot of the other counties in Iowa, particularly areas that maybe not been traditionally habitat for the rusty patch, they've completely disappeared. And then, of course, kind of north central, Story County area on north is a little more of their habitat, native habitat area, and many are disappearing there. So,
well, let's talk about our event coming up on the 20th of August to celebrate the birthday of Prairie Rivers of Iowa. Butterflies, there's two ways you can say this. Butterflies, bees, and brews, oh my, or butterflies, bees, and brews, oh my.
So the plight of our pollinators and other wildlife in Iowa can be kind of a bit of a downer sometimes. So we are using this celebration to celebrate not only our 21st birthday, but some of the comeback and some of the efforts that have been done to increase habitat and native plants and all the things that go along with that for a better environment and the return of native plants that help our general health and environment and the pollinators and wildlife that it all protects, feeds and protects. So
what's going to happen on Friday the 20th?
Yes, happening on Friday the 20th. I think we start at 4:30, and it goes till 7, so you can kind of come and go as works for you. The tickets are available, and that includes a good craft brew from Alluvial Brewing, which we're very excited about. They are going to make a special batch of honey mead from locally sourced honey, as well as a type of raspberry beer. And of course, they'll have all their other regular offerings of craft brew as well. There's going to be informational booths on about environmental conservation, and then what's really fun is there are going to be some prairie walks available, guided by our pollinator and wildlife expert, David Stein, as I mentioned. Music by Susan Clark, the singing scientist. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. Susan does some great work and a variety of styles, from jazz to easy listening to, you know, country. It just pretty much covers about everything from what I understand. So I'm looking forward to hearing her. Going to be food trucks available, Traveling Pig, Hungry Boys, that are both local to the Ames area, Story County area. So I know a lot of listeners are familiar with those. Some great food there, and it's just going to be a good time for everyone.
Why pick Alluvio? Is there a connection between, how do I phrase this, beer and butterflies and bees?
Well, there is, particularly when you're really talking about this honey mead that's going to be made. But, you know, pollinators, of course, are responsible for, are a big contributor to crop production in the U.S. and around the world. So, a lot of native plants require pollinators to pollinate themselves and to reproduce and thrive. Really about 80% of, almost 90% of flowering plants rely on pollinators, as well as about 60% of crop plants rely on pollinators to reproduce. So, that's a big connection there. As I said, the mead that Alluvial is brewing is going to be from using locally sourced honey from central Iowa. So big connection there. And then beyond that, we have a pretty close connection with Alluvial. We do some work for them. And another big piece is they've got some native prairie. At least restored some native prairie near the brewery, so right close by, and give everybody a chance to kind of see what that looks like and explore the possibilities of what you can do on your land, whether it's your backyard or, you know, a large farm. So some big connections there.
And I heard word there might be some type of a raffle or silent auction or some. Items there too for people to get.
Yeah, there's gonna be a raffle. We're still kind of finalizing the details on that, so I can't divulge everything there yet until we get it firmed up. But some of the themes, if you will be, there's some tickets to some Iowa State sporting events. There'll be kind of a local gardening package. And an outdoor package that may include some outdoor sporting equipment, some outdoor accessories for your yard and garden, and those type of things. So we're kind of working that out, but there definitely will be more to come on that. So go watch our website, watch our social media, just search for Prairie Rivers of Iowa, and then. You'll see all the updates on that fun stuff.
Can we talk about how to get a ticket for this?
So tickets can be purchased. You can go to our website, go to the events page, but if you can't find that, which is still pretty easy to find, but we'll make it even easier for you. There's some direct links right to that page from our homepage at prrcd.org, or just Google Prairie Rivers of Iowa. We're going to come up. And so there'll be some links to purchase tickets there. Staff and board members, of course, will have some tickets for sale as well. So,
thank you so much for coming in, both of you. That was Doug Cooper and Mike Kilner from Prairie Rivers of Iowa, who came to tell us about the 21st birthday of Prairie Rivers, and which was on is will be on Friday, the 20th, 4:30 to 7 p.m. at Alluvial Brewing Company. We're closing out our show with a bit of history about our recently renamed Iowa Creek. Steve Lekwa, retired Story County Conservation Officer, will answer the question, who were the Iowa? And following that, we have a little bonus with a garden entrepreneur who developed a way will keep critters out of her garden, and if you're interested, out of yours.
I'm Steve Lekwa, and I write a weekly column for a number of the area newspapers called Naturally Speaking. The following is a column I wrote for June 24th, titled, Who Were, Are the Iowa? I find it interesting that so many place names in the Midwest have come from Native Americans. Wisconsin, Illinois, Kentucky, Minnesota, the Dakotas, Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa are but a few of the state names that have Native American origins. County and city names with Native American origins are even more numerous. I think it's safe to say that few people living in those places today know much about the people their homes are named after. It's been said that history is written by the victors. Most of what we think we know, even the names of Native Americans who lived on the land before us, was written by people of European descent. It isn't surprising, then, that many of the names and spellings come from the French, who were the first Europeans to have significant contact with, trade, and even warfare with the natives who lived here in the late 1600s and 1700s. The names they used and tried to pronounce and spell were often not the names that the people themselves knew themselves by. Too frequently, they were derogatory terms the French learned from tribes who were enemies of the people they wrote about. A creek that flows through western Story County was recently renamed from Squaw Creek to Iowa Creek. I like that change. But who were or are the Iowa? It's impossible to tell the story of an entire tribe in a few short paragraphs, but perhaps a few bits of information will help us to understand at least a little more about them. The Iowa were once part of the Winnebago tribe, or Ho-Chunk people, along with their relatives, the Missouri and the Oto. They still refer to the Winnebago as their grandfathers. Before European contact, they lived near Green Bay, Wisconsin. They spoke a language called Chiweer that was, in turn, from the Siouan language group. The Iowa, Missouri, and Oto left the Winnebago over a period of years and headed west. Perhaps it was to find better hunting, or perhaps it was due to pressure from more eastern tribes that already had contact and trade with the Europeans. That often meant that they had guns that more western tribes did not yet have. The Otoes continued farther west into today's Nebraska. The Missourians headed southwest into today's Missouri. The Iowa hunted, fished, and raised crops in various places over the years from southern Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin to the Missouri River and south into northern Missouri. They claimed that at one time, no one could set foot into any part of that area without them knowing it and first granting their permission. They were living near the mouth of the Platte River when Lewis and Clark visited them in 1804. Iowa is not a name they called themselves. Spelling of their name for themselves varies, but has been written as Bakoje or Bahoje, spelled B-A-X-O-J-E or P-A-H-O-J-A. Iowa is a name the French learned from the Sioux. They spelled it Iowa, A-Y-U-W-H-A. And it meant something like the sleepy ones. Interestingly, the name Sioux came from their enemies, the Ojibwa, and it meant something like sneak or enemy. Their own name for themselves was Dakota or Lakota. The Iowa tribe loved the land they lived on and didn't want to leave. The Sac tribe, under Chief Keokuk, drove the Iowa from their homes just before American settlement, in turn drove them farther west as well. European diseases like smallpox decimated their numbers more than warfare. The Iowa tried to demonstrate their claim to the land from southern Missouri and from Missouri to Minnesota, and from the Mississippi Valley to Nebraska with a hand-drawn map of the entire region showing where their villages were and had been and the trails that connected them. They presented this in Washington, D.C. Still, Iowa Chief Mahaska, White Cloud, was forced to cede to the United States all claim to their land in 1837. He led the Iowa to two reservations, where they remain to this day as the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma and the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. Their ancestors would approve of a phrase we use today, Iowa, the beautiful land. It certainly was a beautiful land, the hundreds of years that the Iowa, the Pahoja, called this place their home.
Before we go, I'm adding a quick story of Dr. Patricia Tice, whose ingenious invention, titled Plant Patron, was designed to protect her plants from critters, raccoons, rabbits, deer, and other animals, without harming the animals or using chemicals.
How did you decide you needed something to help you control your critters?
I have been gardening for many years, and I've always struggled with the problem of pests or critters harming my plants. We live in the Raccoon River Valley, so we have a lot of rabbits, we have a lot of raccoons, we have a lot of deer, and I would plant a new plant somewhere on our acreage, any place, and the next morning I would go out and the plant would have been dug up by a critter in the night. So it was very frustrating, it was annoying, and it got very expensive because I lost some of the plants. And so this led me to invent a plant protection device that I call the Plant Patron. And the Plant Patron protects new and existing plants from critters like raccoons, rabbits, deer, fox, skunks. And the Plant Patron is good for the environment. It's humane to animals. And it's attractive enough to serve as garden art. And what I've learned is that the Plant Patron is the only device that has allowed my plants to thrive, because a critter will not disturb a plant with a Plant Patron protecting it. They just won't. They can't get into it. They can't tip it over due to the spikes that go into the ground that anchor it. About 50 years ago, the school was no longer going to be used, so they began to dismantle everything inside of the school and selling it off to people who wanted it. And one of the things they were selling off was, in the gymnasium, there were steel light covers up on this high ceiling that protected the lights from flying basketballs. And when they brought those down, they were bolted onto the ceiling. And I thought, golly, that would make a good thing for the garden. And so I bought 5 of them. I brought them home. And I used them for 30-plus years in my gardens, and they worked. And that was the early prototype to the plant patron, was a covering from the school gymnasium that protected the lights and basketballs. The problem with it was the raccoons would come along and they would see this device over the plant and they could just knock it over. They could knock over that steel device. And I thought, I've got to come up with a better design that they can't knock it over. And so I submitted the idea to the Iowa State University College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. They have a Bruce Rastetter entrepreneurship program. And I submitted the idea to that program, and they accepted the idea of the plant patron into their program. So there were 2 Iowa State University students who served as interns. We started to put together the engineering designs for the plant patron. We built a business plan for the plant patron. We designed a logo for the plant patron. Everything came out of the entrepreneurship program at the Bruce Rastetter Center at Iowa State University. And that's how it all came about in terms of putting all the pieces in place for it. The interns began to call around the country looking for people who could manufacture the plant patron. And we asked these manufacturers 3 questions. Number 1, do you bend steel or can you bend steel? Number 2, can you powder coat that steel? And number 3, do you drop ship? And those were the 3 questions that were asked of the manufacturers. From about 17 manufacturers that we contacted, we narrowed it down to 5. And we finally ended up with going with Sorum Manufacturing in Nevada, Iowa. They were local. They did a terrific job. They developed a framework for manufacturing the plant patron, and they are still our manufacturer of record today.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Gina McAndrews and myself, Susan Franzen. Our guests were railroad historian Bob Bourne, Lisa Hine of the Natural Heritage Foundation, telling us about building the High Trestle Trail, Doug Cooper and Mike Kellner announcing the 21st birthday party of Prairie Rivers of Iowa, and Steve Lekwa telling us about the Iowa, as well as Patricia Tice telling us how she developed the plant patron.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, you can hear a rebroadcast of Capital Week, originally aired Monday evening at 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. If you want to become a member, you can go to our website at khoifm.org and hit the yellow Donate or Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell all your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.